Good morning, class. This is Bio 231, Human Anatomy, July 29th. We're in the respiratory chapter. Hopefully we'll finish that off today, maybe move into digestion. And let's take a really good look at the schedule because we don't have a lot of days left in class. So schedule's on the right-hand side. And like I said, today is July 27th, 28th, 29th. Today's the 29th, Wednesday, respiratory system. And then one more lecture this week after today. We're going to cover digestive system. Then next week we've got two lectures on Monday and Tuesday, one on urinary system, one on diversification system. Then on Wednesday is your last exam, exam number 4. And don't forget on Wednesday, August 5th is when your last practicum is as well in lab. Okay, let's see, any other announcements? I think you have a quiz today in lab, right? Is there a quiz today in lab? And I told you in lab that there were 4 figures on the quiz, but last night I sent out an email saying that there's only 2. And I defined those for you. So let me see if I can find those 2 figures. Did anybody not get that email? Everybody got that email? Fantastic. Okay, well maybe I'll just point the figures out to you as we get through them. All right, and so let's move into respiratory system unless you have a question. Anybody have a question on schedule? What's on the quiz in lab? Other things with regard to the class? Okay, that is good. I'd like for things to be clear. All right, so last time we started talking about the respiratory system, and I didn't talk much about the functions of the respiratory system, and it's a good idea to know what the functions are as we are learning the structures. All right, so ventilation is one of the functions. Ventilation just means moving air in and out of the lungs. And so that's kind of a mechanical process, so we got to learn something about the mechanics of ventilation, moving air in and out of the lungs. And then gas exchange in the lungs is an important function. And of course, that works by diffusion, so the membrane has to be very thin to allow for diffusion. So there's diffusion between molecules that are air inside the lungs and the blood. And then also respiration refers to the transport of these compounds through your body in the blood, delivering oxygen and removing CO2, right, dealing with those two gases. And then we're also interested in gas exchange between blood and the tissues. So if there's gas exchange in the lungs, okay, what kind of blood vessels do we find in the lungs? Okay, if there's gas exchange in the lungs, what kind of blood vessels do we have in the lungs? Yeah, capillaries, right? So anytime you see that word exchange, you should think of capillary. All right, and then we see exchange between blood and tissues. So in this area between blood and tissues, what kind of blood vessels do we see? So we see more capillaries, right? So systemic capillaries between blood and tissue, and then pulmonary capillaries between air and lungs, right? Or between air in the lungs and blood that's in the lungs. Okay. All right. Let's classify the airways a little bit. The upper respiratory tract includes the nose, nasopharynx, oropharynx, laryngopharynx, nasal cavity, and pharynx. And I see all those structures on the slide. For instance, here's the nasal cavity, and I can see the 3 nasal conchae that we've talked about before. Here's the oral cavity, and there is a hard palate, which is made up of the maxilla and the palatine bone, which is in your anterior part of your mouth or anterior part of the floor of the nasal cavity, and then the posterior part is what we call the soft palate. All right, so there are some muscles there which are responsible for swallowing because it closes off this opening from the oral cavity into the nasal cavity when you swallow, and that's really important, especially for an infant, okay, because this area has to close off in order for the infant to develop pressure in the oral cavity so that they can nurse, so that they can suckle, right? And so that's important. If an infant can't get nourishment, then that's failure to thrive, and that could be a life-threatening situation. So we need to know a lot about the hard palate and the soft palate. This area posterior to the nasal cavity is part of the pharynx, but it's a subdivision all by itself, so we call that the nasopharynx. Then posterior to the oral cavity is the oropharynx. Oropharynx is a passageway for both air that comes through the nasal cavity and food that comes through the oral cavity. And then here is the laryngopharynx. That is behind or posterior to the larynx. Right? And we talked a little bit about the larynx last time. The larynx has a number of different cartilage pieces. Some cartilage pieces are hyaline, some are elastic. And in particular, this one right here, the trapdoor, that is elastic cartilage. And it changes shape, it bends down, and it covers the opening when you swallow something so that food slides over the epiglottis into the esophagus and then into the stomach. Right? We don't want food when you swallow to get into this airway because then, right, it would occlude that airway and you would choke, and you might even choke to death. Right? So that's important to know that. All right, so these are the three parts of the pharynx, all right, and that's part of the upper respiratory tract. Okay, here is your figure for lab quiz today. So let's go over some of these things. So I can also see the lower respiratory tract here. All right, so here we have a nostril. That's an opening. Sometimes we call that the external fauces. And then back over here, we have the internal fauces and nasal cavity with the three nasal conchae. And the job of these nasal conchae kind of act like airplane wings, and they order air so that air flows through the nasal cavity nice and smoothly in what we call laminar flow. And then it has very low resistance, so air flows into this cavity and out of the cavity very easily. Right? If there's a lot of turbulence in this area here without these little airplane wings, then that would increase the resistance and it would be harder to breathe. And maybe not so much during the day when you're awake, you could compensate, but for instance, if at night when you're sleeping and you can't think about it, right, then it would make a huge difference. Then you might even actually wake up in the middle of the night numerous times, right, gasping for air if it wasn't easy to breathe. Here we have the opening of the Eustachian tube. And, okay, so this is all in the nasopharynx. Here is a little structure, a part of the soft palate that sticks down in the back of your oral cavity. That's the uvula. That's a little piece of tissue that, when you swallow, helps occlude, right, this passageway between the nasal and oral cavity. And finally, here is that part of the lymphatic system that we've been talking about. Okay, so here's the palatine tonsil. There are two on either side. And I see the other two tonsils as well. Here is the pharyngeal tonsil way up at the posterior of your nasal cavity. And then here is just a singular lingual tonsil at the posterior tongue. So all of these are lymphatic tissues that fight infection. And it is kind of ironic that their job is to fight infection, but sometimes they become chronically infected themselves, and then it is possible that the only treatment would be to remove them, okay, with a tonsillectomy. Okay, here is a narrowing of the entrance into the oral pharynx that we call the isthmus of the fauces. And then let's go down to laryngopharynx. Well, for sure, here is the esophagus. And then here is the larynx. We're familiar already with the epiglottis, that trapdoor. And epiglottis just means on top of the glottis, and the glottis is just the hole, the entry, the doorway into the larynx, or the doorway into that respiratory tract. And I see some folds right here. These are vestibular folds. These are vocal cords. These are the things that vibrate when air passes through them. And we're going to see a cartilage that adjusts the tension in these vocal cords that changes the pitch with which they vibrate at. Okay. So larynx, then inferior to the larynx is the trachea, and you can see that there are tracheal cartilages as well. So the larynx is held open all the time. The trachea is held open all the time, as opposed to the esophagus, which is closed all the time unless you're in the process of swallowing something. So why is one tube open all the time while the other one is closed all the time? And probably the best question to ask is, why is an airway open all the time? Why doesn't it collapse? Okay, and the reason is because when we exhale, we have to pressurize our chest like that. right? And when we pressurize our chest, right, that would also exert pressure on the walls of the airway, right, and it would force them to collapse. And if an airway collapses, then you couldn't get air out of your lungs, right? So these airways are held open all the time, so when there are changes in thoracic pressure, right, they do not collapse and they allow for the expulsion of air from the lungs. So that's an important function. Okay, that's not so important for the esophagus. We'll talk about that in the next chapter. Okay, so right below the larynx is the thyroid gland. And we've talked about the thyroid gland before. One of the cartilages of the larynx is named after the thyroid gland, and that is the thyroid cartilage. And I see it right here. It's the most prominent cartilage on your anterior neck. You can palpate it very easily. There's a prominent projection sticking out, especially in males, that you can feel. That's part of the thyroid cartilage. All right, so here are the cartilages that I want you to know. Thyroid cartilage, cricoid, right, arytenoids, right, and corniculate. You know, corniculate's not in your lab manual. But let's go over some of these other cartilages. These are not going to be on. So this figure here, I told you, was on the lab quiz, but as it turns out, or I'm sorry, probably this one. I told you this one's going to be on the lab quiz, but it is not, right? So this one was deleted from your lab quiz today. So let's go back and look at this anterior view. Something that you're familiar with already is the hyoid bone, which is tucked up, right, inside the mandible. And it acts as a point for ligaments and for various muscles that are important in breathing and articulation. And the rest are pretty much cartilages. Here is the tip of the epiglottis, which is posterior. Then here is the thyroid cartilage. And then here is the laryngeal prominence that's sticking way out. Commonly, you might call this the Adam's apple. And I have no idea why it's called the Adam's apple. Maybe I knew at one time, but I have no clue anymore why that was now called Adam's apple. Okay, and then here is what I consider the largest cartilage of the larynx. And this is the cricoid cartilage. And it doesn't look very big compared to the thyroid, but we only are seeing the anterior part of it. So we need to look at the whole extent. The cricoid cartilage completely encircles or completely girdles the airway, but the thyroid cartilage is only found in the anterior part of the larynx. All right, so let's look at a nice lateral view. Here's that lateral view, and again, here is the hyoid bone, the epiglottis, right, the trapdoor that covers the glottis when you swallow something. Then here is the thyroid cartilage. Here is the prominence, and then down below it is the cricoid cartilage, and you can see that it forms a complete circle, and posteriorly it is very large. Right? It is even larger than the thyroid cartilage. Thyroid cartilage only goes right on the more anterior part of the larynx. Okay, so we have some soft tissues inside the larynx, vestibular folds and vocal folds. So here is the vestibular fold, which is superior. It runs along the margin of some muscle, and this is sometimes what we call a false vocal fold or false vocal cord. All right, so that is above the true vocal cord. The true vocal cord is attached to the arytenoid cartilage, and this is the one that can change position. There's a muscle that the arytenoid muscle is attached to it, right, and it can rotate this arytenoid to increase or decrease tension on the true vocal cord, which is what? Inferior to the vestibular fold. And that changes its just natural frequency of resonance or the pitch when air passes through this. All right, so what cartilages do we want you to know something about? We want you to know epiglottis, thyroid, cricoid, arytenoid. And I don't believe cuneiform or corniculate. I know for sure these two are not in your lab manual, so we're not going to focus on those two. Got some really good models in lab where you can identify all these different structures. All right, so that's it for the larynx. And when you get an inflammation of the larynx, you lose your voice. That's called laryngitis because there's inflammation of the true vocal cord right here. And, well, of course, also the vestibular fold as well. All right, posterior to the larynx is the trachea. That's an airway, and you can't allow that to collapse ever, even with changes in thoracic pressure, and hence there are cartilages in the trachea as well that hold it open all the time. They don't completely encircle, they kind of look like a horseshoe, and so they're horseshoe-shaped cartilages that run the whole length of the trachea. There's a little muscle in the back, right? So one reason why the trachea doesn't have completely encircling cartilages, let's go back to this figure here, is because when you swallow a bolus of food, it would get stuck in the esophagus because the trachea would be in the way. It wouldn't allow the esophagus to enlarge. So when you swallow something, the esophagus enlarges by pushing into the trachea for that moment in time. All right, so there's no cartilage on the posterior part of the trachea. There's a muscle there called the trachealis. All right, so that's why these cartilages don't go around the trachea completely. Okay, the trachea. Enter to the esophagus. I like that. We've seen that. It's lined. Oh, that's interesting. Here's that trachea. It's lined with a pseudo-stratified ciliated columnar epithelium. All right, so this A is just A. It's not a A period P S C C. Right, pseudo-stratified ciliated epithelium, and that's a pretty cool kind of epithelium. All right, so here it is right here. I can see the cilia. And here's that trachealis muscle, there's the esophagus, here's some hyaline cartilage that makes up the trachea, and then here's that pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium, and there are some cilia, and then I can actually see some mucus right on the apical surface of this epithelium. Here's the basement membrane, and here is a goblet cell. So how does this mucus get onto the apical surface of this epithelium? Where does this mucus come from? Yeah, from this goblet cell right here. Okay, so the job of that goblet cell, it's kind of columnar in nature, secretes mucus onto the surface, which is sort of interesting. It's kind of sticky and slippery all at the same time. Right? So it's not a solid substance. When dust particles or bacteria touch it, they get stuck in that mucus. And then here are cilia, and the cilia are all sweeping in one direction. They're sweeping that mucus, and if anything's trapped in the mucus, then it removes that material from your lungs. Because we don't want to breathe in bacteria and other kinds of dust particles because your lung is a closed-end sac. If it gets in your lungs, there's no easy way to get it out, right? It can't just pass straight through. So which way do you think these cilia are sweeping all of that garbage that we breathe in? Sweeping it up or sweeping it down, would you guess? Down, getting it out of the trachea, down, 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 into your lungs? Or would it be better to sweep it up so that it leaves your airway, leaves your lungs completely? Okay, so the best choice there would be they sweep up to remove mucus and all that debris that's trapped in the mucus. It sweeps it up into your oral cavity, and then what do you do with all that mucus and debris that is in your oral cavity? Well, you just swallow it down, okay? Unless you're a baseball player, then what do? Then you can spit it out all day long, right? But for us, most people, we just swallow it and get it rid of out of our system. Okay, the cartilaginous rings in the trachea just keep the trachea open, and it doesn't matter if there's pressure changes in the thorax or not, right? The trachea is held open, and the posterior segment has that trachealis muscle to allow for a bolus of food to pass through, the esophagus, right? When you swallow something, because the esophagus has to expand, and it can partially expand into the trachea. Right here, because of that trachealis muscle, because there isn't a hard ring of cartilage that is posterior. Okay, so that's the trachea. If we move down a little bit further, all right, the trachea is going to bifurcate into the right and left lungs, and I think we saw this last time, the right lung is bigger because there's no heart on the right side of your thorax, and so there are three lobes on the right side, only two lobes on the left because your heart is taking up some of that space, and we call that notch in the left lung the cardiac notch. So that's pretty easy to remember. All right, so the trachea bifurcates into something that we call a bronchus. All right, so trachea brings air to a bronchus, and there are two, one to the left, one to the right, And so we call that a primary or main bronchus. And if you look at a bronchus, it has cartilage as well. It is held open all the time. Right? And then the bronchus enters along either the right or left, and it bifurcates again into smaller tubes. And you can see that these tubes here also have cartilage associated with them. So this is a bronchus. This is what we call a secondary bronchus. And then a secondary bronchus is going to bifurcate once again to two smaller ones. Right, that would be a tertiary bronchus, and you can see that it has cartilage as well. So the larynx has cartilage, the trachea has cartilage, and all bronchi have cartilage. That's pretty much a definition, right, for a bronchus. The bronchial tree right here inside the lungs, if it has cartilage, it is a bronchus of some kind, okay, whether it's a primary or secondary or whatever. But finally, a bronchus is going to give way to, okay, so here I see a bronchus giving way to some smaller tubes. And these are microscopic tubes in general, so we can't really see these very well unless we have a microscope. And when I look at a bronchiole, I see a terminal bronchiole, then I see a respiratory bronchiole, right, and then I even see some alveolar ducts over here. Do you see cartilage on any of these pieces of the of the respiratory tree? On this terminal bronchiole, do you see cartilage? No. I see some smooth muscle, right, that can contract, and it decreases the diameter of this tube. And remember, whenever you change the diameter of a tube, you change the flow through that tube by a factor of, not just a factor of 4, but by a power of 4. All right, so if this diameter changes, right, you have to multiply that change in diameter by itself once, and then twice, and then three times, and then four times. So small changes in bronchial diameter drastically, right, changes the amount of air that can flow through a bronchiole. And since a bronchiole does not have cartilage, it can change shape. So when somebody has, for instance, an irritation of these smooth muscles right here, like in the condition of asthma, then there's a constriction, there's airway constriction, then it becomes very hard for somebody to move air in and out of their lungs when these things contract. Fortunately, there are some medications where we can get these muscles to relax pretty easily. It's part of your sympathetic nervous system, right? And in physiology, you'll learn exactly what kind of receptor is there that will respond to norepinephrine. Remember, that's the important sympathetic neurotransmitter. All right, so here is a terminal bronchiole. Here is a respiratory bronchiole, a little bit smaller, and it's not a bronchus because, again, there's no cartilage. Then I see this little bubble on this particular bronchiole. This right here is what we call an alveolus. And an alveolus is that structural and functional place where gas exchange happens. So air flows through the larynx, through the trachea, through a bronchus, finally into a bronchiole, and then into an alveolus, and that's where it stops. So if there is exchange of gases within this alveolus, what also has to be surrounding this alveolus if there is exchange taking place there? And you all know that answer? It's not shown on this diagram really well, okay? It is a capillary. Right, so a capillary surrounds this alveolus that allows for exchange. And we call this a respiratory bronchiole because it has this alveolus that allows for exchange. Well, the terminal bronchiole does not have an alveolus. Right, so there are some differences between a respiratory bronchiole and terminal. The similarity is they're very small. They both have smooth muscle. Neither has cartilages, but the respiratory bronchiole has this little functional unit for gas exchange, which is what we call an alveolus. All right, well, we need a whole lot more than just one. So there is a grouping, okay, of alveoli, and we call that an alveolar sac. And the alveolar sacs are connected together. Air can flow into each of these sacs via alveolar pores. Maybe on the next slide I have it when we zoom in right here. And there are ducts, right, which bring air into each of these individual alveoli. All right, so let's zoom in. Let's see what we can find. Here are those alveolar pores. Here's that respiratory bronchiole bringing air into an alveolar duct, and from the duct it flows into each of these alveoli. And I can see some things around each of these alveoli. Let's see what it is. Oh, here's a wonderful picture. Okay. Well, since for gas exchange, we need an arterial supply, right? So we need to bring blood to all of these alveoli. And also, here are the capillaries that allow for exchange. Oxygen goes into the blood, CO2 leaves, right? Exchanges with air inside an alveolus. So when I look at these blood vessels right here, easy to see the capillaries, the capillary network. All right, now, what is this vessel right here, this blue one? You should be able to name this one. And this is a fantastic slide because it's not labeled for you, but you should be able to name this blood vessel in less than a second. What would you call this one? It's in the lungs. So it's a pulmonary, right? It's a pulmonary, part of the pulmonary circulation. But now what kind of vessel is it? Okay, anybody awake enough to see what's going on here? Tricky, tricky, tricky question. It is a pulmonary artery, right? A pulmonary artery is low in oxygen. It's an artery because it takes blood away from the heart to the lungs. That's what a definition of an artery is, right? An artery doesn't necessarily have to have highly oxygenated blood in it, right? So a pulmonary artery is low, relatively low in oxygen, but it's still taking blood away from the heart to the lungs. Exchange takes place. Now here is blood that is returning to the heart. It has picked up oxygen, right? And blood that is oxygenated actually looks red. So this red vessel that I see is a, less than a second, you should be able to tell me. This is a pulmonary vein, right? So remember, the pulmonary circulation is opposite compared to the systemic circulation in this sense. All right, so you see a nice alveolar sac, you see some alveolar pores, right, which allows for gas to enter all of these different alveoli. See a nice capillary network that allows for exchange. And I see something else, which is really nice, and I haven't seen a physiology book with this, but this is hugely important. If we look at the alveolar sac way here on the left, the capillary network has been removed, but I still see something surrounding all of the alveoli. Right, I see all of these lines right here. These lines are hugely important, and it's labeled on these slides. So what are all of these lines that surround an alveolus? It says elastic fibers, right? Okay, so what's the property of an elastic fiber? Is it really strong, 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 can't stretch? Or is it really, really weak so that when you stretch it, it just rips apart? It's a kind of fiber that can stretch, right? And then when that tension is released, right, the fiber goes back to its normal length, its resting length. Okay, so these elastic fibers are really important because when you inhale, the alveoli expand and stretch, so it stretches those elastic fibers, and then when you want to exhale, you relax muscles, and what do those elastic fibers do? They contract the alveolus, and they help expel air from your lungs. Okay, and without these elastic fibers, then it's really hard to exhale air from your lungs. It's terrible when people don't have these things. They have a hard time breathing. Well, so somebody that doesn't have elastic fibers can inhale pretty much normally, right? But air doesn't go in their lungs because the air that went in previously hasn't left. All right, so in order to inhale new air, the old air has to leave the lungs. So without these elastic fibers, you can't exhale very well. There's a nice picture. All right, let's zoom into an alveolus. Let's look at the next slide. Okay, let's stay right here. All right, so here is one of those little pockets that air flows into, and the pressure is equalized between all of the alveoli with all these alveolar pores. And I see, if I look on the edge of an alveolus, right, there is an epithelium there. And could you describe this epithelium to me? Or we could look over here or over here. What does that epithelium look like? And if we look at it over here, we can also get a nice impression. Or here, we can get a really good impression of what's going on. So how do we characterize an epithelium again? Shape of cells, number of layers. How many layers do you see right here? I see one. So what kind of epithelium is that? Simple, and the cell is like a pancake, so that is why by shape it is squamous. So this is a simple squamous epithelium, And you know that simple squamous epithelia are specialized for exchange. That's exactly what you have right in the capillary. The endothelium is just a simple squamous epithelium. I see some blood vessels, right? So here are capillaries that form a network around the alveolus. What I don't see on this slide necessarily, it might be on the slide, but I don't see it immediately, are those elastic fibers that surround the alveolus, but don't forget about those. I see some other kinds of cells inside the alveolus, like this one right here, okay, here and here and here and here. Okay, they're either blue or purple, and you can see they have like a lot of little projections on them. These are macrophages. These are monocytes that have left the vascular system, and they're crawling around inside an alveolus all the time looking for junk that doesn't belong there, like bacteria, viruses, fungi, spores, dust particles, right? And it helps remove those particles, and if it's a bacteria, these macrophage then takes it to a germinal center inside your body, right, so that germinal center can learn what that bacteria looks like. Germinal center then can design a strategy to kill those bacteria. All right, so those bacteria actually leave the alveolus and get into your body via these macrophages. All right, so you got the macrophage. That's one type of cell. Another type of cell, right, is this pancake cell here and here. That's what we call an alveolar type 1 cell. It helps make up the wall of the alveolus. And then we have another fancy cell. I see one here, and I see one here, and I see one here. This is a type 2 alveolar cell. And the job of this type 2 alveolar cell is really interesting, but you have to appreciate some physical chemistry. So the question I usually ask is, do you think water is slippery or sticky? Is water slippery or sticky? Slippery, yeah, because if there's a puddle of water on the floor, you step on it, you don't get stuck, you kind of slide over it, right? So that's everybody's general impression in a nice macroscopic sense. But in a microscopic sense, water molecules do like to stick together, right? Just because of the special properties that you learn about in a physiology class. Right, so water is extremely sticky, and I'll do an experiment next time or in lab that will demonstrate that to you, but maybe you could do a little mind experiment. Let's just say that you have two plates at home, and they're dry, and you put them together and put them on the table, and then you grab the top one when they're dry and lift the top one, and it's easy to separate those two plates, right? They just pull right apart. Now, the second condition, put some water between the plates. Put them together, put them on the table, grab the top plate and lift the top plate up. What's going to happen to the bottom one? It's going to be stuck to the top plate, right? And that's because of the surface tension in water. Water molecules do like to stick together. It produces something called surface tension. As a matter of fact, water molecules like to stick together so much that some animals can even walk right on the surface of water. They're not heavy enough to break through that surface tension. Has anybody ever seen some kind of animal walk on water? And what was that? Like an insect, like a water spider, various kinds of insects, right? And there's even some reptiles that can run really, really fast. They can run right over the surface of water for a short period of time. Right? But if we step on a stream or a lake or something, we just go kaplunk because we weigh enough to break through that surface tension. All right. So water has surface tension. It acts like glue. There's water on the inside of this alveolus. And so since there's water, if this top part of an alveolus would touch the bottom part over here, and since there's water, they would get stuck together. They would get glued together. And if they're glued together, air can't enter the alveolus. Air can't enter the alveolus. Oxygen can't enter this capillary. And of course, that's a terrible situation. All right, so there is a compound that reduces surface tension. It prevents that surface tension so that when the walls of the alveolus do touch each other, they don't get stuck. And that is what we call surfactant. So a type 2 cell is a surfactant secreting cell, right? And so the way they came up with this name surfactant, it just means surface active agent, right? So it acts on the surface tension, which is that tension between water molecules that exists everywhere where there's water molecules. And as a matter of fact, maybe you could even think of surfactant as being like a soap or a detergent. And if you ever put soap on your hands with some water, is it sticky or is it slippery? It's really slippery when you have soap right on your fingertips and you move them back and forth. Okay. All right, so let's zoom in to this area right here. I see a nice capillary. So we zoom into this region, and here we have a capillary. So here is the wall of the alveolus. And you can see it's just a simple epithelium, and it's squamous. We talked about that already. Then here is a little basement membrane that attaches the wall of the alveolus to the wall of a capillary. And what can you tell me about the endothelium? What kind of endothelium is used to make a capillary? It's specialized for exchange. It's a simple squamous epithelium, right? So simple squamous on the wall of the alveolus, simple squamous for the wall of the capillary. This basement membrane right here is very, very thin. So this distance that oxygen has to diffuse across from air in the alveolus into the blood is very, very small. Diffusion can take place easily only through very short distances. That's why these squamous cells are used. So sometimes when we look at these two cells in the basement membrane, we call that the respiratory membrane. That's the membrane that these gases have to diffuse across, right, in either direction, like CO2 leaving your body going into the air and alveolus, or oxygen going from air in the alveolus into your blood to be delivered to all of your tissues. That membrane is pretty important. What's not shown on this slide would be a little layer right here. That's too bad. I would like for you to realize that there is a layer on the wall, the interior wall of the alveolus, that reduces surface tension. What would you label that little layer right here, right on the surface of this type 1 alveolar cell? You would label it surfactant, right? So when you think of the respiratory membrane, don't forget about that layer of surfactant. Most textbooks, most people don't include it as a layer of the respiratory membrane, but you should pretty much know it's right there. And it's hugely important. It's produced by what, the type 2 cells? The type 2 cells become activated by stress when you're born. Right, so a fetus, when it experiences the stress of being born, it activates these cells. These cells then secrete surfactant, and that helps the infant inflate these alveoli, which are collapsed in utero. Right, and which is the reason why we've all had our behind slapped as soon as we were born, to help us cry, help remove this fluid from our lungs. And if there's surfactant there, they inflate, the alveoli inflate. If there is no surfactant in the alveolus, then the alveoli do not inflate, right? And the infant cannot breathe, and that's terrible. So that's a condition that can develop when somebody is born via cesarean section. It is not as traumatic event to the fetus being born, and sometimes that doesn't activate these type 2 cells. And so with a cesarean section, an infant might be experiencing respiratory distress as a result of that. And then somebody has to make up their mind what to do in that particular case. Right. These alveolar type 2 cells also mature in a very late stage of gestation. So if somebody is born prematurely for whatever reason, by cesarean or whatever reason, these type 2 cells are not mature enough to secrete surfactant, and in that case, then that infant will also be experiencing respiratory distress. They can't inflate these alveoli because the type 2 cells aren't active. What can somebody do with a prematurely born infant, right, to help compensate for their reduced pulmonary function because there's no surfactant in their lungs? You put them in an incubator, right, which helps regulate their temperature, which is important. But there's also a higher concentration of oxygen compared to air, so that oxygen has a higher driving force. The concentration gradient, right, is higher, and that helps deliver oxygen to their tissues, even though their lungs are not fully developed. All right, so again, that's really important that you know something about these type 2 alveolar cells. Okay, pleural cavities, I don't even know if I have a picture to show you, but I'm sure you're familiar with pleural cavities. Maybe I have a picture, maybe not. Maybe right here. Okay, so the lungs are in a cavity, right, that is not open to the outside world. The inside of the lung is, but the outside of the lung is not open to the outside world. So what kind of membrane lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world? And remember, there's two kinds of membranes, two important kinds of membranes. If we think of cavities, there are membranes that line cavities that are open to the outside world, and then there are other kinds of membranes that line cavities that are not open to the outside world. The ones that are open to the outside world are called mucous membranes, like that membrane on the trachea. That's a mucous membrane, and it just so happens that it has goblet cells and secretes mucus, right? But the membrane that lines the pleural cavity, or cavity that's not open to the outside world, is a, who knows, is a serous cavity, right? And a serous cavity is a little bit more complicated than a mucous membrane because it has three parts. There's one part of the membrane that's on the surface of this visceral organ. The lung is a visceral organ. Deep inside a body cavity is what that means. And so that is the visceral division of that serous membrane. And it's the pleural membrane, so we would call this the visceral pleura. Right? And then the membrane that lines the wall of the thorax, then we call that the parietal pleura. And then there's a space between them that we call the pleural cavity, pleural space, and it's filled with serous fluid. Okay, so it's got these three parts, right? So you got the parietal pleura, visceral pleura, and the pleural cavity filled with pleural fluid. And that, in this case, the water in this pleural space does not have surfactant in it. And that's pretty important. Why do you think that this space right here should not have surfactant? Because when we move air in and out of our lungs, the size, the volume of the thorax changes, right? The thorax expands, and we want the wall of the lung to be attached to the wall of the thorax so that when the thorax expands, so does the lung. If the lung was able to separate from the wall of the thorax because there would be surfactant in there, then, right, the volume of the thorax could enlarge without changing the volume of the lung, and then air would not enter the lungs. So in this case, it's good to have water in the pleural space because it acts like a glue. It gets the lungs stuck to the wall of the thorax so that when there are changes in the volume of the thorax due to skeletal muscle contracting, the volume of the lung changes as well. Okay, so that's the pleural membrane. Mechanics of breathing. Breathing can take place or takes place in two different ways. What is this right here? Oh, that just shows the pleural membranes again. Okay. All right, so what are the two ways that we classify breathing? One is what we call quiet breathing, and the other is what we call forced breathing. These are two ways that we bring air into our lungs. We can break it down into these two categories. There's maybe some room in between these, but let's break it down for initial discussion. Quiet breathing is what you're doing right now. You are not exercising. You're not hyperventilating. You're in a relaxed state, but you're still breathing. Probably you're not even aware of it, but you're breathing. We call that quiet breathing. That is mostly due to the contraction of the diaphragm. Okay? And the diaphragm contracts, it becomes depressed. What happens to the diaphragm? When the diaphragm is relaxed, right, it's dome-shaped. When it contracts, it gets pulled inferiorly, see it way down over here, and thus this inferior margin of the lung gets pulled inferiorly, increasing the volume inside the lung. Right, so quiet breathing is due to contraction of the diaphragm. That's the primary muscle for inhalation. Now, what about expiration? That's another phase of breathing, right? The two phases are inspiration and expiration. For quiet breathing, and this is passive, completely passive, when you relax the diaphragm, it has sufficient elastic fibers in the diaphragm that it goes back to this dome-shaped structure. And when it does, that decreases the volume of the thorax. And so for quiet breathing, inspiration is active. It requires this muscle to contract to increase the volume of the thorax. But expiration for quiet breathing, this is pretty strange, is completely passive, does not require any energy. Right, so it's due to relaxation of the diaphragm, okay? But also, what else is helping expel air from your lungs? It's not a muscle, but it is the elastic fibers around all those alveoli. Right, so quiet breathing, expiration completely passive, inspiration is active, requires the diaphragm. Right, the other type of breathing, which we call forced breathing, right, when we are hyperventilating during exercise, for instance, there are other muscles that are necessary to increase the rate of flow of air in and out of our lungs because you're breathing faster. All right, some of these other muscles for inhalation are the pectoralis minor. Pectoralis minor is attached to ribs laterally, right? External intercostals. External is that layer that is superficial between the ribs. Right, and so don't forget, this is what inspiration, so the external intercostals are for inspiration. It doesn't match up nice and perfectly there. These external intercostals pull on the ribs and help elevate the ribs. It pulls the ribs up. All right, sternocleidomastoid also helps. Serratus anterior is attached to ribs, and all of these help elevate the sternum and the ribs. When that happens, right, let's look at the wall of the thorax. Here is where the lung was initially. When all of these other muscles contract, not only the diaphragm, but the sternocleidomastoid, external intercostals, right, serratus anterior, the wall of the thorax gets pulled out laterally and superiorly, and it increases the volume of the thoracic cavity, right, and then that's how inspiration takes place. Those are the muscles necessary for forced inspiration, right here. All right, so your ribs actually change position. For forced breathing, for quiet breathing, that is not the case. What about for expiration? Well, for quiet breathing, we said it's passive, which is due to elastic properties of the lungs and muscles, right? But for forced breathing, it becomes active. It is no longer passive. Things have to actually contract. Not the external intercostals, but the internal intercostals. The internals are going to pull the ribs back down, right? The externals pull up, the internals pull back down just because of the fascicle arrangement, right? All of the abdominal muscles, like the rectus abdominis, internal oblique, external, transverse abdominis, when they contract, right, they pressurize your contents of your abdominal cavity, right, and force them inside your body, but it also forces abdominal contents organs up into the thorax. And when those abdominal organs move up into the thorax, that also helps act kind of like a piston, forcing air out of your lungs. All right, so these are muscles that are necessary for rapid breathing or forced breathing. All right, so there's a big difference between quiet and forced breathing and inspiration and expiration. Here is a law that I put off talking about. It's called Boyle's Law, and it just says there's a relationship between volume of anything and the pressure inside of it, right? And the relationship is inverse, so that when you decrease the volume of a certain amount of gas, if you decrease the volume, the pressure goes up. Okay, and that, I think, should be pretty easy to visualize. Think of an air balloon or a water balloon and squeeze down on it. You decrease the volume of that balloon when you're squeezing on it. What happens to the pressure inside that balloon? Well, it goes up. And if you squeeze too much, the pressure increases so much, what's going to happen? The balloon is going to pop, right? So when you squeeze on a balloon, that increases pressure. And if it's the lungs, when your lungs are squeezed down by these different muscles, the pressure inside the lungs increase and air is forced out of your lungs. Inspiration is the opposite. Okay? When the volume increases, the pressure decreases and a fluid flows from high pressure to low, so the air is going to flow from your surroundings, which is high pressure, to low pressure, that is inside the lungs. All right, so that's called Boyle's Law. So the pressure changes are due to volume changes, and when there are pressure changes, then air flows either in or out of the lungs. That's the mechanics of breathing. Okay, here's something that's really kind of fun to talk about. Gas exchange in the lungs. So, of course, we need to have simple squamous epithelium, really, really small distances through the respiratory membrane. Okay, but I want you to have an idea of surface area. What the heck is surface area of something? And our bodies have dealt with this in a, through evolution in a really interesting way. Okay, so what is the surface area? Could you tell me what the surface area of this table is right here? You need a ruler, right? You need to measure the width of the table, okay, which is, in this particular case, about 30 inches. And then you have to multiply that number by the length of this table, which I won't measure, but it's 40-something. So the surface area of this table is, you'd have to multiply the width times the length, so 30 times 40-something. That would give us the square inches of this particular table, and that we could get an idea of how many objects we could put on this table, right? If this table, if the surface area of the table enlarged, how many objects could we put on the table, more or less? More, right? So as surface area increases, we could put more objects on the table. All right. Well, what about the door? We can consider the surface area of the door right here, right? And we would need a ruler to do that. What do we need to measure? Two things. The width of the door and the height of the door. Multiply those two numbers together, then we get the square inches or square meters or square feet of what the surface area is. All right, so let's measure this door. And this just happens to be a meter stick. And, look, this doorway is exactly 1 meter wide. That's kind of handy because it's easy to multiply one by anything. But we still need to measure the height. So what's the height of this door? It is 1 meter, okay, 1 meter. So we've got to multiply one by one plus one plus another meter. Oh, and look, it's exactly 2 meters. That's really nice. So what's the surface area of this door? It is 1 times 2, or 2 square meters. All right, so what? So this is, what, a doorway. What's the function of this doorway? It allows for exchange, right, of people from inside the room to outside the room, or outside to the inside. So when you think of surface area, what I really want you to think of is what? Exchange. A doorway. Surface area is a doorway for exchange. Right? And since this doorway is 2 square meters, what would happen if we were to make this doorway bigger? What would happen to the exchange rate? Make the doorway bigger, how many people could get through? More or less? More at the same time. Make it a garage door, right? Make it like 10 times the size, right? Then instead of having maybe 2 or 3, how many people could get through this door at one time? 2, 3, maybe 4 if we got a running start right through the door, okay? Maybe 4 people, but what about a garage door? How many people could go through a garage door at one time? Hard to imagine, 40, 50, I don't know, 100 maybe if they got a running start, right? So as the surface area increases, exchange increases. So in the lungs, right, we need a large surface area. So how do I want you to think of surface area? As a doorway, right, for exchange. So exchange is taking place in the lungs. Do you need a big doorway or a small doorway? Yeah, you need a big garage door or even bigger, right? So what is that surface area? If we were to take all of those alveoli, peel it like a grape and put them on a table like this, flatten them all out, right? How big of a table would we need to put all those alveoli? And we have about 300 million alveoli in our lungs. I think I can turn the lights back off. Like that. Okay? And if we were to take all 300 million of these alveoli, put them on the ground so that they all touch each other, there's no spaces between them, the surface area would be 70 square meters. What's the area of that doorway? It is 2. And in your lungs, there's 70. Right? So how is it that your lungs have this huge surface area? And that's because If you take this big surface area, all those alveoli, we fold them up. Well, not we, but evolution has figured this out for us. Taken this big surface area, folded it up so that it fits into a smaller space. The surface area is still there, but all of those folds, right, make it take a smaller space. So what is 70 square meters in real terms? How can we think of square meters? A lot of us didn't grow up with meters even to know what that is. Well, that's the area of half of a tennis court. Maybe you've seen a tennis court. Tennis court is pretty big, right? So the area for exchange in our lungs is the size of half of a tennis court, right? And I can't imagine why I would want to be, right, as wide as a tennis court and tall as half of a tennis court, right? So it's really nice that my lungs are all folded up on each other and fits into a much smaller space, but that surface area for exchange is still there. Okay, so when we say surface area, what is the everyday word that you want to think of? Doorway. Yeah, doorway for, and the function of a doorway is exchange, right? Okay, and as the doorway increases in size, so does exchange, right? Okay, so that's what we call directly related. If one increases, the other variable increases. All right. We talked about this before, the respiratory membrane, right? It's the wall of the capillary, interstitial space, wall of the alveolus, and that's where your book stops. There might be some questions in your book. Those are the three items. But I also want you to remember that layer of surfactant, right? Secreted by the type 2 alveolar cells. Surfactant reduces surface tension, so alveoli, the walls of the alveolus, don't get stuck together. Okay, what about control of respiration? Let's think of that diaphragm. So here's my cursor. Here's the diaphragm. What kind of muscle is this diaphragm? How many different kind? What are the major classes of muscle in your body? You got skeletal, you got cardiac, you got smooth, right? So the diaphragm is which one of those? It's got to be one. It is skeletal muscle, right? It is skeletal muscle, and that's sort of interesting because you know that skeletal muscle is under voluntary control. But you don't think about breathing all the time, right? But that's because there's a special division in our brain that kind of takes over the diaphragm so we don't have to think about breathing, so that the diaphragm contracts in a nice rhythmic fashion even when we're sleeping, even when we're not conscious, right? So, but don't forget, the diaphragm is skeletal muscle, and the proof of that is, we're going to lecture for maybe another 15 minutes or so, but to prove to you that the diaphragm is a skeletal muscle, I could stop breathing and not say anything for 15 minutes, right? I can stop my diaphragm from contracting via my conscious control. So it is skeletal muscle, right? Okay, so what controls that skeletal muscle when we're not thinking about it? There's a respiratory center that is in the brain stem. And remember, the brain stem is the medulla and the pons put together. Let's see if I have a picture. Do I have a picture of that? Oh, I do. All right, so here's cerebellum, right? And then hypothalamus, that looks like a little pituitary gland. Here is the pons, here's the medulla. I don't see spinal cord, but I see three centers right here. These are nuclei, so these are what, nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And the ventral, right, so here is the ventral respiratory group. This acts like a pacemaker. Just like your heart has a pacemaker that causes the heart to contract in some kind of rhythmic fashion, right? This is the pacemaker that sends signals to the diaphragm to contract even when you're not awake, right? Then we have this dorsal respiratory group, and it inhibits this pacemaker. It slows it down. Then there's even another group up over here called the pontine respiratory center that can inhibit the one that inhibits the pacemaker. So what happens when you inhibit an inhibition? That's a way of like stimulating, right? So if you want to increase inspiration, then this pontine center kind of takes over. If you want to decrease the rate of inspiration, this dorsal respiratory group kind of takes over. Otherwise, this ventral respiratory group is just going to act at its own pace. And these things are active even when you're sleeping, which is fortunate, right? They're working just fine. Right? But they do get information from your body, like how much CO2 is in your body, how much oxygen, and other kinds of factors, so that they know how to regulate your respiratory rate. People do get strokes of the brain when there is a thrombus and it decreases blood supply to some part of the brain. And remember, that brain can only stay alive for only 3 minutes without blood supply. Some people get a stroke in the area of the pons and the medulla. And in that particular case, right, one or more of these nuclei that are responsible for automatic breathing get damaged. They don't function, right? And in that particular case, then when somebody takes a breath, it has to be under conscious control all the time, like reaching out for a cup of coffee or a Coke or something, right? So that means that they can only breathe when they're thinking about it and when they are awake, right? They can't breathe when they're asleep. And so when they're asleep, then they have to be put on a respirator. So a machine has to breathe for them, and then they can get a good night's sleep, okay? And that happens to people. When that happens, okay, that disease is called Odin's curse. When somebody has to breathe consciously every time, can't breathe unconsciously. And it's usually damage to one, well, it is damage to one of these nuclei right here. Could be due to a stroke, could be due to other kinds of reasons. All right, so don't forget, diaphragm is skeletal muscle. You have control of it, but you have these other centers in the brain that can take over when you're not thinking about it. Question?
Right.
So these three centers, the ventral respiratory group, that's the pacemaker, the dorsal and the pontine respiratory center, all three of these are necessary for you to have normal ventilation, right, normal breathing when you're not thinking about it. It's not part of the autonomic nervous system, right, but it's a special system that allows you to breathe even though you're sleeping, okay, or through other kinds of activities. All right, so how do signals get from this ventral nucleus, right, down to the diaphragm, which is the most important muscle for inspiration? Well, there's a nerve that goes there, and you have to find it on that nerve plexus model in lab. It's called the phrenic nerve. Phrenic nerve comes from the cervical plexus, which is in your neck, right, and then it goes all the way down to the diaphragm. Without this phrenic nerve, then nerve impulses cannot get to the diaphragm, and the diaphragm will never contract. Right, which means that you can't inhale quietly. You have difficulty inhaling or can't even inhale, right, for forced breathing. And in which case, then, if that phrenic nerve gets damaged, you have to be on a respirator or be around somebody that can breathe for you. What do we call that technique when somebody can breathe for you? That is called CPR, right? And a lot of people in here are certified with CPR. Okay, so that is the phrenic nerve, the importance of the phrenic nerve. And remember the origins of the phrenic nerve come from three places. It goes through the cervical nerve plexus. The three origins are C3, C4, and C5. And if you recall, the advantage of a nerve plexus is that it allows for alternate routes for nerve impulses to take to get to a vital organ. So if one of these roots is damaged, say C3 can't transmit electrical impulses, then C4 and C5 can take over and somebody can still breathe, right? If there's damage to C4 and C5, a person can still breathe because of impulses coming from C3. But if there's a spinal cord injury above the level of C3, so signals can't even get down to the level of C3, then nobody can breathe, right? Somebody has to breathe for them, or a machine has to breathe for them. So how are you going to remember the origins of the phrenic nerve? There's a little cute saying that says C3, C4, C5 keeps you alive, right? Because that's the origin of the phrenic nerve going to the diaphragm that allows for inspiration. All right, so what are some things that affect these respiratory centers? Okay, because we don't want to think about oxygen concentration in our body and the acidity and CO2 levels. Fortunately, there are chemoreceptors in our body that monitor these things, right? So a chemoreceptor is just something that's responsible to notice what? Some kind of stimulus. And a stimulus would be a change in some chemicals. What are some of these chemicals? Carbon dioxide, that's a byproduct of producing ATP. pH is a measure of acidity, right? Our body can change its pH or the level of acidity, and for a normal person, it can't change very much. Only under very, very small changes in pH are allowed to maintain life. So where are these chemoreceptors? Well, there's two areas. There are central receptors, and by that we mean in the central nervous system, right? And there are peripheral receptors, not in the central nervous system, in some other location in your body. Right, the central chemoreceptors are located in the medulla and the pons. And that's pretty nice because that's where these respiratory centers are. And this is how they work. If there is an increase in CO2, or if there's an increase in that byproduct of producing ATP, that will stimulate ventilation. Right? When your muscles start to use up ATP, mitochondria replace it, CO2 is being produced. So what happens when you exercise? You have an urgency to breathe, right? Because of these chemoreceptors, the central chemoreceptors that are telling these respiratory nuclei to increase the rate of ventilation, also the depth of ventilation as well. If there is a decrease in pH, as what happens during exercise, right, that will also increase ventilation. These two things are the most important chemicals that will adjust the rate and depth of ventilation. Now, when we say decrease in pH, we need to talk about that because we have never talked about that. pH is a measure of acidity in your body. When the pH number goes down, what happens to acidity in your body? You know, it's kind of tricky, even when you get into a physiology class. The relationship there is not a direct relationship, it's inverse. So as the pH number goes down, the acidity goes up. Right, but we just talk about pH. Everybody's familiar that when pH number goes down, the acidity goes up. And so here we say when CO2 goes up or when acidity of your body goes up, that increases ventilation. The peripheral chemoreceptors, okay, where are they located? They're not in the pons and medulla because that's where the central ones are. These are located, we've talked about it before, the carotid sinus. Can you kind of picture where that carotid sinus is? It's right where the common carotid bifurcates into the internal and external carotid, right at that junction right there. That's the carotid sinus, right? And there's a little bit of a bulge in that area. And it also has these chemoreceptors. The aortic arch also has chemoreceptors in it. So these two locations, these receptors are sensitive to oxygen concentration, okay? But in order for these receptors to affect ventilation, the oxygen concentration has to decrease a tremendous amount, not just a little bit. That's why I have all these down arrows, right? So when somebody becomes very deficient of oxygen, then you will have an urgency to breathe, okay? But not before then. So what really regulates your ventilation is the amount of CO2 in your body, not oxygen. Right, and then when I learned that, I was really surprised because I know how important oxygen is to make ATP, and I would have thought that your body would be very interested in the amount of oxygen because that would determine how much ATP your cells could be making. But that is not the case. The case is carbon dioxide is what really regulates respiratory rate and depth and pH as well, okay, due to these central receptors, okay. That has some interesting, couple of interesting ways maybe that will help you remember. And that is when somebody is brain dead, okay, so the cerebrum is dead, they can't appreciate anything around them, okay, but maybe the brain stem is still alive and the brain stem is maybe allowing the person certain kinds of autonomic functions. Or maybe part of the brainstem is dead and a person can't breathe anymore automatically. They're put on a respirator, even though there's no living tissue in the brain, and the heart is continuing to beat. And the heart will beat as long as the heart is getting oxygen. right? Because that's the job of the SA node. So the heart can be alive while the brain is dead, if somebody is on a respirator. And then sometimes people have to make a really hard decision about one of their loved ones that is on a respirator but doesn't have any brain function left because it's dead. Do we keep this person on a ventilator, keep their heart beating, and breathe for them artificially, even though they have no idea what's going on, their brain will never come back, okay? And then somebody has to make a decision to take them off of a respirator. And then eventually their heart will stop, right? And the person then can be pronounced dead and they can, whatever they do, rest in peace. The rest of the family can go about their business, right? And there's just a recent case of this. Day before, somebody was taken off a respirator, made big news, not because they were taken off a respirator, but because they finally realized this person was dead. And who was that just recently? That was Whitney Houston's daughter, right? Died, don't know if it was an overdose or drowning or whatever happened. Okay, her family finally took her off a respirator and her body stopped receiving oxygen. Okay, so when you're taken off a respirator and there are no central receptors working, then that person's body is no longer sensitive to CO2 and pH, right? But the aorta, right, still has functioning chemoreceptors. And what do these chemoreceptors in the aorta monitor when somebody's taken off of a respirator? Oxygen concentration, right? So after a period of time, so it's not just a second, but it's after a period of time, could be 15 seconds, 30 seconds, maybe as long as a minute, the person's body uses up oxygen. The peripheral receptors become stimulated because oxygen concentration decreased drastically, and then what happens? That's a powerful stimulus for inspiration, right? So even though somebody's dead, you take them off a respirator, and maybe even after a period of time, they start to try to inhale. They go through a gasping reflex. They call that agonal gasping. And if you're a family member and you don't know, nobody warned you that that was happening, what would you feel like? Here's your loved one, you've taken them off a respirator, and now they're gasping for air, trying to stay alive. That's your feeling, but that's really not the case, right? Because their brain is really dead. It's just a reflex that is taking place. They call that agonal breathing or agonal gasping. So that's one interesting thing about this oxygen concentration. There is one last story that I can tell before we finish up next time, and that is there are people that like to spearfish, right? They like to fish, not with a fishing pole, but with a spear gun, and they have to be really quiet so they don't take oxygen or air down with them. They dive without tanks. They hold their breath before they go under the water, and they can go really deep, right? Easily 30 feet, right? And stay down there for a period of time looking for fish really quietly. Okay, and so one of the techniques is, so that they can hold their breath longer, is to hyperventilate before they dive, right? If they hyperventilate, they get rid of a lot of CO2 in their body when they hyperventilate. And what does CO2 do? It's a stimulus for ventilation. If you artificially decrease your CO2, right, then that's going to delay this sensation that you need to inhale, right? So when you hyperventilate before you dive, you can dive deeper and stay down longer. That's just because of these central receptors. But, right, you're not breathing and you're exercising when you're underwater. What happens to oxygen concentration? Because you're underwater and you're exercising, it starts to decrease, right? And it decreases drastically before somebody has a sensation that they're running out of oxygen. And as a matter of fact, okay, the oxygen concentration can be so low that they actually lose consciousness, right? They lose consciousness, and where do they lose that consciousness? They're underwater. Oxygen is way down. What does their nervous system do? It stimulates them to breathe rapidly, and where are they? They're 30 feet underwater, unconscious, and then they start breathing water, and then what happens? They drown. Okay, so that's another interesting scenario. Hopefully all these are people that we call free divers. Hopefully all free divers know that they can't push their limits too much, because if they pass out underwater, right? These other parts of their nervous system are going to force them to breathe, even though they don't want to, and they don't even know they don't want to because they're unconscious, right? So that's interesting, how respiration is controlled by CO2 and oxygen in different ways in two different locations of the body. Okay, so when we come back, we're going to talk about a couple other centers before we finish this chapter, the higher centers like the cerebrum, right, proprioceptors that are in muscles and joints, and some other receptors, right, can also affect the rate and depth of respiration. So sign-in sheet is going around, and make sure that you have checked your email to know what figures are on the lab quiz coming up around 10 o'clock. Right, I sent that out to everybody. It's the sagittal view in the respiratory system, so not the larynx, right? And for digestive system, it's only the stomach. It's not the large intestine. But the ones that I've taken off the quiz are important exam figures that you should know nonetheless. So if you study them, then that's fine. That's good. Okay, anybody have questions? Yeah. Yeah?
Don't they depressurize in the chamber?
Oh. If somebody injures themselves while diving, like if they are diving deep and then ascend too fast, then bubbles can form in their blood.
In their blood.
And if there's a bubble, it gets into a vessel that's small enough, it blocks that vessel off.
Yeah.
And then it will, that tissue that needs that oxygen dies. That's in the brain, happens all over the body.
Yeah.
Okay. So to treat that, they use a hyperbaric chamber. Yes. There's a couple around LA. So if somebody, that condition is called the bends. It's really dangerous, can kill you, right? And it's really pain, really, really painful. So they take that person that's been injured, put them in the hyperbaric chamber. The hyperbaric chamber is pressurized to the point to where they were at underwater. The bubbles in their blood then dissolve. They dissolve back into the blood, so the bubbles go away. And then the pressure in the chamber is gradually decreased, the atmospheric pressure. And when that happens, the bubbles don't reappear. Okay. So the pressure of that hyperbaric chamber is to make them like be underwater at that depth, but not really underwater. And a physician can be in the chamber. Right? They can be receiving medication and other kinds of support, which they couldn't get if we just took them down under the surface in the ocean.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the pressure in the hyperbaric chamber is slowly decreased, so the bubbles don't reform. And there's a hyperbaric chamber someplace, maybe Downey, someplace pretty close to here, and then there's one at Catalina Island.
Oh, yeah, Avalon.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the one at Catalina's run by USC. It's in their environmental center there.